Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
My name is Patrick Lahey, and I am the co-founder and CEO of Triton Submarines, which has offices located here in Sebastian, Florida, and in Barcelona, Spain. My background is, I suppose, began as a commercial diver in the early 1980s. I began work as a commercial diver in the oil and gas industry and was lucky enough to work for a commercial diving company in the early part of my career that actually owned some submersibles. And they asked me when I was in my early 20s if I'd be interested in learning how to operate one of those machines, to which I enthusiastically responded yes. And I made my first dive in a sub in 1982 off the coast of California on a drilling rig, you know, down to about 1400 feet, you know, kind of like about 450 meters maybe. And it was magnificent. It changed my life. The experience was so powerful and something that excited me so much that I just decided I was going to dedicate my life to these machines. And for the last 42 years, I have been working with human occupied vehicles or submersibles.
All right. Do you mind if we jump right into some student questions?
Yeah, please jump in.
Oh, we have a question from Arnaud, and Arnaud is in France. He had a really good question. Go ahead and unmute to ask your question, friend.
Hello. How it feels to be at 10,000 meters deep?
Exhilarating. One of the most exciting and most important dives of my life. You know, Arnaud, I have been diving subs, as I said, a long time, made tens of thousands of dives, and they're all wonderful. And each, there's so many of them that were important to me and ones that I'll never forget. But diving to the bottom of the ocean, to the bottom of the Marianas Trench at 10,965 meters, 32 meters, I beg your pardon, or just under 36,000 feet, was important because we demonstrated we had built a machine that was capable of going to the deepest and most remote place in our world and was able to do that repeatedly and safely in a class vehicle. So in terms of how you physically feel, well, the nice thing is you're inside of a protected pressure hull, which in this case is made of titanium that's 3.5 inches or about 90 millimeters thick. So you're at one atmosphere, just like we are right now. Surface pressure, we're able to have a normal conversation. So it's actually quite a tranquil experience. It's cold at the bottom of the ocean. The water temperature is hovering just over 0 degrees Celsius, or right at the just above the freezing point. So it's you got to be dressed properly because the hull gets very cold. But for me, sitting in that thing, looking out those viewports on that, you know, wonderfully unique landscape or seascape, was one of the most powerful experiences of my life. And I was very fortunate to be one of the group of people that was out on that historic mission. But thank you for your question.
Now, you discussed a little bit, because we got emailed this by one of the kids, about preparing physically because it gets so cold. Is there anything mentally you need to do to prepare for that?
I don't think so. I mean, unless you're somebody that's uncomfortable in a confined space, because, you know, that's the very definition of a confined space. The diameter of that particular sub is 1,500 millimeters or about 59 inches. I beg your pardon. I'm going to turn off my phone. I apologize. I didn't realize that it was on. Anyway, it's a fairly compact space, but not uncomfortable. Not very different from sitting like I am right now in this chair. You have another person sitting next to you, and you know, you're not going to jump up and do jumping jacks inside the sub, but it's a place where you can comfortably spend 12 to 14 hours, which is how long those dives typically take. It's about a 4.5 hour journey to get to the bottom. and about a 3.5 hour journey to come back. And then whatever time you spend at the bottom in what we describe as the exploration phase of the dive, that's usually no less than 3 or 4 hours in duration. So, you know, those dives are extraordinarily long. So in terms of preparing physically, you want to make sure you don't eat a lot of food and don't drink a lot of liquids, because I don't have to tell you what has to happen if you drink a lot of liquids. And so the preparations really involve, you know, being sensible about that, dressing appropriately because it's cold in there. And we don't want to waste energy using heaters and so on, because the energy that you have is precious and you want to use it for lights and for propulsion and for your other cameras and sensors and so on. But it's you know, a very special and very singular experience that I wish more people, like all of you on this call, could have the opportunity to experience firsthand, because it would change your perception of the ocean absolutely forever. Make you appreciate it perhaps in a way you may not right now.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine. We have a question from across the globe. This is Hector. Hector, go ahead and ask. You had a pretty good question. Go ahead.
Hi. What is something about submarines that someone that doesn't work with them wouldn't know?
Okay, that's an excellent question. Let me think about that for a minute. I suppose there's probably quite a few things. Maybe I'll start with the mythology that surrounds human-occupied vehicles. I think popular perception, you know, widespread pretty much around the world uniformly, people's perception is that submarines, submersibles, human-occupied vehicles are dangerous and scary and complicated, and only crazy people like me would get in them. But that would be absolutely incorrect. You know, human-occupied vehicles, submersibles, are extraordinary machines that allow you to visit, I call them magical machines, that allow you to visit a part of our world you couldn't see any other way, and to do it in comfort and safety. You know, so perhaps one of the things is that, you know, why are they so safe? Part of the reason they're safe is because of the standards that we have to comply with to get the designation of a passenger-carrying submersible. It's incredibly arduous. They're much safer than the car that people get into every day without thinking about it, you know, much safer than so many things that we do without thinking about it. But because they're unusual, because not that many people have the good fortune to dive in them, people think they're dangerous and scary, but they're not. They're incredibly safe. They're actually quite simple. They have to be. And, you know, when you think about the environment that they're working in, which is like the most hostile environment on the planet, they have to be simple. They have to be reliable. They have to be robust and durable. And all of those things are things that, I mean, people, I guess, grow up watching movies about submarines, and most of those movies don't paint the subs in a very positive light. And that's unfortunate, because I can tell you I've had some of the most thrilling and memorable experiences of my entire life have happened in submersibles, in subs.
So exciting. We have Avalit. My apologies if I mispronounce your name. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hello. My question is that if it was difficult, it was a difficult decision for you to dive in, and if you were prepared to do it.
Well, I would say that if you're talking about the dives that we made to the bottom of the ocean in 2019 and subsequently in additional years, we did some more in 2021 as well. I would say that yes, they were difficult. I would say that it was the most difficult undertaking, certainly in my life, and I'm sure in the lives of all those who were fortunate enough to be part of it. But sometimes, you know, the most important things you do, the ones that are the most memorable, are the most difficult. And of course, it was going to be difficult, which is why nobody had ever done it before. You know, there had been two previous dives to full ocean depth, but they made a single dive and no more. Whereas the sub that Triton built has now made 20 dives to full ocean depth. And I've had the privilege of making five of them. So it was difficult to get there. But once we did the engineering and the design work and the manufacturing and the testing, then actually, the sub's ability to make those dives to that extreme depth, nearly 36,000 feet or 11,000 meters, was predictable, reliable. I mean, we were making dives to the full ocean depth site every other day, which was unprecedented and demonstrative of when you build something properly, you design and engineer it appropriately, and you test it appropriately, then you can use it, and you can use it repeatedly and with confidence. Not arrogance, but with confidence. And does that mean you can be reckless or careless or cavalier about safety? Absolutely not. I believe that when you approach any operation in the ocean, you have to do so with great humility, with deep respect and a reverence for the ocean, because the ocean is incredibly powerful, and you have to show the ocean due respect anytime, you're operating in it or around it or on it.
I bet. Real quick, how long does it take to get down to that depth of the bottom of the
So
ocean?
the full ocean depth, it's about a 4.5 hour journey to reach the bottom, and then it's about a 3.5 hour journey to come back up. And usually the exploration phase, as I said, will last 4 hours to maybe even 6 hours. So the total dive time can be anywhere from 12 to even 16 hours. So they're very long dives. Imagine being in a vehicle, a small vehicle, for that length of time. Most people would take, bathroom breaks and breaks to stretch and walk around. You're not afforded that opportunity when you're in a sub, 36,000 feet underwater.
That is unimaginable. We'll burn through a few more student questions then let you go. We have Christopher. Christopher, you had a really good question. Go ahead and ask.
Hi. When I have a question, when you were in a submarine inside the sea, it was like being in space.
I think, people often use the space analogy. Of course, I've never been to space. I can't say that it would be like it exactly, but certainly from the standpoint of the fact that once you've adjusted your buoyancy and so on, you're floating, you're neutrally buoyant. And that's the condition that you often try to get to as a diver. And I suppose that does make it very much like being in space. In fact, astronauts train in pools and swimming pools to try to simulate zero gravity. And being in a sub, that's neutrally buoyant in the ocean, I suppose probably is very similar to being in space. Of course, there's also a huge difference, and it's an important one to point out at this moment, which is that in space, you deal with the absence of one atmosphere because you're in a vacuum. The bottom of the ocean, we're dealing with 1,100 atmospheres. The pressures that are being exerted on the structure that we're in are immense. You're talking about 16,000 psi, or about 1,100 bar, a tremendous amount of pressure. And in some ways, that makes being in the deep sea more complicated than being in space. In terms of the structural design of the things that you bring into the deep sea.
Brilliant. Absolutely fascinating. We'll go with a few more and then we'll let you go. We have Einhao. Einhoa. Apologies if I'm mispronouncing your name, but go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, what are the best animals you ever seen diving?
Well, I have been incredibly fortunate in my lifetime, in the dives that I've made, to see some truly extraordinary things in the deep sea. And I did an expedition with James Cameron in 2003, and we were filming for a documentary called Aliens of the Deep. And during that dive, we filmed this very, when we were in the sub, I remember looking off in the distance and seeing what looked like a plastic bag floating in the water. Then we went over to it, and we put our lights on it, and Jim filmed it. And it's actually, if you look at the cover of Aliens of the Deep. It's that creature that we saw, which all with all kinds of things happening inside of it. I think it's called a salp or something like that. To me, that was incredible. I mean, I'm not a scientist or a marine biologist or anything like that, and seeing that was pretty interesting. I also had the privilege of seeing the deepest fish. It's a fairly small little fish called a swire snailfish. And that was at 8,000 meters, which I guess is as deep as you can ever go as a fish. I guess go beyond 8,000 meters, I guess there's certain things that the animals can't do, and the only things we typically see in the very deep ocean are crustaceans, and you don't see fish because the fish can't survive at 11,000 meters. I'm trying to think of other great things. I've seen hydrothermal vents, and I've seen all kinds of interesting types of animals. One of our subs was used to film the giant squid, which was something that had never been done before. I think it was around 2011 in an expedition off Japan. There were three people in one of our Triton subs, and they captured footage of an animal that naturalists had been hoping to see for all of, recorded time. And they captured, I think, 22 minutes of the animal from about 2,000 feet or 680 meters all the way down to 800 or 910 meters or something. So an amazing. This animal had a body 4.5 meters tall with arms that stretched down another 6 meters. So the overall length of the animal was 10 meters or over 30 feet. I wasn't in that sub, but I bet you that was a pretty incredible thing to see.
That'd be terrifying. Seeing an Architeuthis, that would be terrifying to see a 30-foot.
And amazingly, it's a very gentle creature that was just kind of looking in at the people in the sub, and they filmed it and almost looked metallic as it changed from silver to gold. I've been able to see six gill sharks and other unusual deep sea sharks in the subs. And just any time you see something, I mean, even seeing, I remember seeing a seal, like at 1,000 feet. I didn't know seals could swim that deep, but it's an incredible thing to imagine a mammal. And of course, shark whales go down much deeper than that. I've heard even 5 or 6,000 feet, 2,000 meters underwater. Imagine being able to hold your breath and go that deep. That would be the ultimate.
It is wild. We have a question from Arnaud. He wanted to quickly ask about Ocean Gate. Arnaud, go ahead and ask your question, friend.
Hello. What did you think about the Ocean Gate submarine accidents?
Well, I'm glad you brought it up because it's one of those things that it's a subject that is deeply troubling on many levels. And actually, before this call, we were chatting about it. But it's important to remember that the Ocean Gate sub was an experimental contraption. It was not anything like the subs that we manufacture or that other credible builders and operators of human-occupied vehicles create. The subs that we build are all certified and accredited. They go through this very arduous validation process. The Ocean Gate contraption, and I call it a contraption because that's what it was not fit for purpose. It should have never carried human beings. It was a tragic and totally avoidable loss of life. We all knew that this thing was going to end in tears, and we had warned the owners and operators of it for 4 or 5 years before that tragic event occurred that what they were doing was reckless and irresponsible. It's important to make that distinction because certified subs, accredited subs like we build and others in our space have a 50-year track record of perfect safety. That's 5 decades with no incidents. But of course, nothing is going to catch a headline like dead people on Titanic, So it unfortunately got a lot of airtime. It streamed across the world and frightened people once again because it reinforced those myths that I talked about earlier. This notion that subs are dangerous and scary and only crazy people get in them, which is simply not true. It's a reputation that has not been earned. And in this case, it's important to remember that that sub was experimental, hadn't been through any kind of a validation process, and should never have carried human beings.
It sounds like it wouldn't even classify as a sub.
It would never have passed certification. I've testified before Congress at the Coast Guard hearings in South Carolina last year. And one of the questions that was asked by a congressman at the time that I did the congressional hearing deposition was, could this thing have been classed? And the simple answer is no. And the reason it couldn't have been classed is because it wasn't made of appropriate materials. It hadn't been tested or validated by anybody. And as a consequence, it should never have carried people. I mean, it's one thing to build experimental vehicles that are being used as robotic vehicles or autonomous vehicles, but when you're putting human beings in a machine and you're taking them into the deep sea, you have a duty of care or responsibility to be held to a higher standard. And that standard is certification, classification. And the track record of class vehicles is unprecedented. Now, 50 years, as I mentioned, of unblemished safety. And
That is amazing.
that's a powerful statement.
That is. And you guys definitely are the leaders in your industry. And that's why I reach out to you guys and not, to
Well,
anybody
thank you. And
else.
it's very kind of you to say. We love submersibles. To me, as I said, they're the most magical machines on our planet because of what they can do and the places you can go. And I don't want people, especially young people, I don't want you to be afraid of diving in a sub. Just make sure it's a certified sub. Make sure that it meets an internationally recognized set of standards. And then you can dive in it with confidence. You can dive in it safely. And you can know that not only did the sub go through this very arduous, review process, but the people who are operating it have been trained and know what they're doing and are not going to take risks or do things that would potentially put you in jeopardy.
That's wonderful. Thank you for touching up on that, because I know a few kids sent some questions about that. We have two more student questions, and we'll let you go. Is that all right?
Absolutely. Happy to answer as many questions as you've got. Like I said, this is a subject that I'm passionate about, and there's nothing more exciting to me than encouraging young people to think about careers in the ocean, careers in STEM, and so on. So please, with your questions.
Appreciate you greatly. We have Noé. Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay. Hello. Are you concerned about the exploitation of seabed with an impact on seabed biodiversity like tourism or metals?
You mean through open from seabed mining, deep sea mining?
Yes.
Yes, I am very concerned about deep sea mining, and I think that we should maintain the moratorium on it until we understand it more fully. It's an interesting thing that we've not really explored these areas that are being opened up to exploitation from deep sea mining. And there are lots of things for us to learn and to discover in the deep ocean. And it would seem quite short-sighted to go down and obliterate these vast swaths of the deep sea when we don't really understand enough about them to know what their importance might be. Not to mention, people think that these areas are devoid of life, and that's simply not true. And finally, the minerals that they're hoping to extract from these deep sea manganese nodules, cobalt and nickel primarily, and manganese, are metals and minerals that are going to be used in battery production. But if you know anything about batteries and battery evolution, the technology and the chemistry of batteries is evolving. In 5 years' time, the minerals or the materials that are going to be used to construct batteries are going to be vastly different than the materials being used today. And it might and probably will completely obviate any benefit from mining. In fact, also, the other thing is trying to recover things in the deep ocean, something I know a little bit about, is incredibly difficult. And their predictions of how much they can recover and how much of that could potentially be put into use, pales by comparison to what's actually needed if you are to believe the predictions. And so to me, I think we should be thinking more about investing in the development of other battery chemistries, things that don't cause, the kind of harm that this type of deep sea mining could potentially have, and focus our energies on developing chemistries for batteries that are innocuous and that are going to provide equal benefits in terms of energy density, but without the negative environmental consequences.
Now you've done like deep sea like salvage stuff like that. Have you
Yeah.
ever discovered a wreck or anything?
Yeah. We have, we discovered the two deepest shipwrecks in the world, the RV Johnson and the RV, I can't remember what the other one is, but anyway, they're very deep, over 8,000 meters in the Pacific. I was involved in the recovery of the Space Shuttle Challenger in 1986, which is a tragic event, but it was an extraordinary salvage operation. At the time, it was the largest salvage that had ever been undertaken. Recovering things in the ocean is difficult. Recovering things in the deep ocean is difficult, like times 10 or 100 or 1,000. It's an incredibly unforgiving environment, and it presents all kinds of technical challenges, and the potential negative environmental consequences are simply not worth the effort. And we should really be reevaluating it. Also, the process that they're talking about using for deep sea mining is pretty indiscriminate. And if you're going to go down there and recover things, you have to be thoughtful about how you do that, so that you don't destroy, wide swaths of the ocean and the unusual animals that inhabit that part of our world. I mean, they believe in the deep sea. I'm not a scientist or biologist, but people believe in the deep sea. There's cures to our energy problems, cures to diseases, solutions to our food problems. There's no question there recently was discovered an organism in the deep sea that kills glioblastoma cells that cures brain cancer. Imagine eliminating that. One of the most successful anti-tumor agents was recovered from a deep sea sponge. So I think it's time that we looked at the ocean differently. And rather than thinking about how we might plunder what's there, we should think about how we can protect it, study it, better understand it, and learn from the vast areas of the ocean that have been unexplored. There's plenty for us to learn, and lots of reasons why we shouldn't launch into another campaign to ravage another area on our planet.
Amen. Amen. We have our final student question is from France. Luca, you had a good question. Go ahead and ask.
So, hello. I was asking, what kind of studies have you done to do this job?
Well, my kind of trajectory through this career was rather unorthodox. I didn't go to university. I didn't get a formal education. I graduated high school, and then I went to a trade school to learn how to be a commercial diver. And during a commercial diving school, we learned how to weld underwater. We learned how to cut steel underwater. We needed to learn how to blow things up and how to salvage and recover things. We work out of diving bells and diving helmets with umbilicals to the surface. And this was, how I began my career as a diver, and it led to other things. And I would have to say that I've been incredibly fortunate in the direction that my circuitous kind of life has taken. And part of that is because of some of the brilliant people that I have met along the way who have helped steer my career and have created opportunities for me that resulted in starting Triton, about 18 years ago. So I know that, if I were to probably go back in time, I might take a different path. I mean, I think getting an education, having a degree in engineering or a scientific degree, depending on what it is that interests you, is obviously has huge advantages. I mean, I came in at the pretty close to the bottom rung of the ladder. My first diving job, I walked into the shop and they handed me a broom and said, "Sweep the shop." So, if that tells you anything about where I was on the pecking order.
That's great. Okay, before we let you go, I always ask this of all of our guests. Is there any advice you can give to these kids around the world, whether they want to go into deep sea exploration or submarines or something completely different? As someone as accomplished as yourself, what advice would you have for them?
That's actually an easier question to answer than you might think to me. And I give the same advice to my daughter, who's in her third year of university. I tell her, I've always told her, and would tell all of you the same thing, which is to do the thing you love, to pursue the thing that you're passionate about. Because when you do that and you pour your heart and soul into it and you give it the effort that you would if it was something that interested you, success is the inevitable result. So do what you love, work hard at it. Success is the inevitable result. And I think if you want to have a happy life and a fulfilling life, that's what my advice to you would be.
Thank you so much, Patrick, for taking the time to talk to us. Thank you, Sophie, for setting this up. I appreciate you and everyone at Triton, and we'll be in touch about some possible field trips, whether it be in Spain or in Florida, wherever our students are at. But before we go, before I end the meeting for all, I traditionally allow everyone to unmute. And can we collectively all say thank you to Patrick and Triton for taking the time to talk
Thank you so much.
Thank you.